You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Anthony DeMar, one of the world's foremost champions of contemporary music, known for entrepreneurial performance projects that expand the repertoire and the audience for contemporary music, including the speaking, singing, pianist genre that he pioneered over 30 years ago with the premiere of Frederick Chevsky's De Profundis from 1992. So begins Anthony DeMar's official bio, which I'll continue by way of introduction in a moment. But first, let me speak to the somewhat unexpected and unusual focus of tonight's program. Given that Anthony DeMar's musical life has been so singular, and his activities so various and encompassing, it was entirely unclear what exactly we might speak about. As I cheekily put it near the start of our conversation, my difficulty with you is, he took that in good spirit, at least once I explained that there were just too many topics of shared interest that we might delve into. And so, allowing the natural, almost chance-determined vagaries of conversation to dictate, we found ourselves talking first about his mostly educational experience with Cage and several of Cage's colleagues, Ivar Mikhashov, Meredith Monk, Frederick Chevsky, primary among them, and then settling deeper into a conversation about Anthony's latest endeavor, a recording project entitled Liaisons, Reimagining Sondheim from the Piano, which celebrates the music of Stephen Sondheim through the commissioned reimaginings of composers from across the musical spectrum. Far afield from Cage, perhaps, but maybe only superficially, as the inclusive design and determined passion of DeMar's massive, now two-pronged recording project would surely have warmed Cage's heart. Being a huge fan of both Cage and Sondheim, it definitely warmed mine. To balance out our meanderings, bringing us back a bit more squarely into the universe of All About Cage, we close tonight's program with selections from an early Koch CD, dating from 1992 and entitled Pianos and Voices, which features works by John Cage and Meredith Monk, with DeMar performing pianos and voices. Anthony speaks a bit about this recording and the works chosen for it, but suffice it to say here, the Cage works included on this single CD span more than four decades. But back to Anthony's bio. Praised time and again by the New York Times, his versatility over the past three decades has inspired the creation of over 90 new works by some of today's most distinguished artists, including Steve Reich, John Batiste, Christopher Sorong, Stephen Hough, Meredith Monk, Paola Prestini, Kevin Putz, Mason Bates, Max Richter, Wynton Marsalis, Nico Muhly, Fred Hirsch, Ted Hearn, and Andy Akiho, among many others. The first 36 pieces in his Liaisons, Reimagining Sondheim from the Piano project were recorded by DeMar and released on the new series label for ECM Records in 2015, engineered by Judith Sherman. This recording was cited on numerous best of lists. The San Francisco Chronicle declared that this irresistible new CD set is a little short of breathtaking. Many of the composers give DeMar plenty of opportunities for virtuoso showing off, which he grabs with gusto. The whole undertaking is a triumph. In honor of Sondheim's 90th birthday in 2020, DeMar extended the project with 14 new commissions, bringing the total compendium to 50 works. The new collection will be released later this year on Avi Records. The breadth of DeMar's programming, from traditional classical and jazz venues to theaters, museums, and non-traditional spaces, speaks to his versatility and virtuosity, as do his performances spanning five continents and his discography of over 20 recordings, including works by Ives, Cowell, Harrison, Cage, Meredith Monk, Chevsky, Del Tredici, and Piazzolla, among others. Since his debut with Young Concert Artists, his accolades and awards have included first prize and audience prize at the International Gaudeamus Interpreters Competition in the Netherlands and the International Contemporary Piano Competition of Saint-Germain-en-Laye in France. Recent performances include the premiere of the Liaison's 2020 works at Kaufman Music Center's Merkin Hall. A Steinway artist, DeMar is currently professor of piano at Manhattan School of Music. He is also a faculty member at the Mostly Modern Festival in Saratoga Springs, New York, each summer, and he has served as new music curator for the Sheen Center for Thought and Culture in New York City. So, Anthony, are you an Anthony or are you a Tony?
I mean, I'm Anthony professionally, you know, but everybody calls me Tony.
Okay. So my baby brother's name is Tony. So I'll
call great.
You. Yeah. He is also an Anthony, but nobody calls him Anthony unless they're mad at him.
That's what my mother used to do. Right. Exactly. Called by both names, Anthony Joseph.
Oh, me too. I was just going to say, I was Laura Diane. And yeah. When Diane came, I had done something.
Yeah.
Is your mother still living?
No, she died in 21. She made it to 100.
Wow.
And then she died a month later. I think that was her goal. And then she said, okay, kids, I'm done. See you later. Uh-huh. she just sort of did it. Things deteriorated in that last several months, but she made it to 100 and she was excited to have reached 100.
So she died in 21?
It's January of 21.
So those last couple of years must have been hard on her.
Yeah. I mean, she dealt with COVID. She stayed inside most of the time, obviously. There were some health things, and she would go to my sister's house because my sister's house was a one-level house, so it was easier for her to move around. And she'd stay there for several months and then go back to our original home, which was a split level.
How much time do you want to leave to play something?
Do you want something from the Cajun Monk disc it wasn't my first recording, but it was my first complete solo recording.
We have that in our archives. So here's my problem with you. Anthony James, is it James?
Joseph.
Oh, Joseph. My brother is Anthony James.
I was named, it was both grandfathers. Because I was the last of five, and there are four girls, and then me.
Oh my God, they must have spoiled you rotten.
No, everybody says that. No, they more or less looked at me as an annoyance.
They tortured you. Yeah, so anyway, so I was sitting here waiting until you got here, just thinking about all the things that I'd really love to talk to you about. With Cage, of course, because this is all things Cage, and we definitely want to touch on that, but that goes pretty far back for you. And you know what I mean? It's really the beginning of you as a recording artist, but that doesn't mean that we don't want to talk about it at least a little bit. I'm really interested in I'm a huge Sondheim fan, number one. So I'm totally interested in your new project. We really need to go there. But the thing that really intrigues me about you, Anthony, is your entrepreneurial work, the way that you have really latched on to things like the singing and the speaking pianist and things like that, which really do open up the possibility of a kind of raconteur, a kind of bringing in other kinds of information to your programs, which do widen audiences. You put that in your bio that it does that, you know, it means to do that. And I'm sure it does. I remember falling in love with Gershwin when I was, I don't know, I must have been in my mid to late 20s. And all of that came about because of Michael Feinstein. Michael Feinstein sat at the piano, played Gershwin tunes beautifully, and just chattered at his audiences, which I thought was very beautiful and enlivening of both the music and my understanding of Gershwin. And I don't know, it was just marvelous. Are you in that vein?
What do you mean?
Are your programs, when you do something, are you simply doing pieces by these composers? Let's talk about Jevsky for a second. Do you talk about Jevsky? Are you interacting with an audience or are you doing this all through music?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you brought up so many different topics now that I can give you the history on of what led me.
Let's start back up then, because that is where I want to go.
Okay. I mean, we can definitely talk about Jevsky and the Sondheim project. You mentioned Cage being part of my career from the beginning. And that goes back to when I did my master's degree at University of Buffalo and studied with Ivar Makashov, and Morton Feldman was there, and Jan Williams was there, and LeJaron Hiller. And it was a very potent time. And Ivar brought, he had a great relationship with John. He brought him up many, many times as a guest in residence. And we did a lot of evenings of John's music, and or interspersed into the, what was at that time, the North American New Music Festival that Ivar organized every year during the 1980s. And it was because I had a background in theater and dance, as well as studying the piano, Ivar really encouraged me to incorporate those other elements into what I was doing, because he said, you know, the new music world is still evolving. This was at the time. It's still evolving. And he said, you know, just aside from just playing the piano, he said, you're going to want to break in by doing things that other people don't do. And so he's the one, Ivar, suggested that I take The Wonderful Widow of 18 Springs and do it solo. He had mentioned that Kathy Berberian had done it years and years before as a solo. And so we did that. And then when Nauth upon Nacht came along a few years later, we, you know, and John said he liked the two of them to be paired, obviously. That encouraged that. And then Ivar would put me on the radio at the University of Buffalo to do these radio shows. Now, Ivar was a master programmer, and that's where I learned so much about creative programming. And so I think that's the reason my programs have always been so eclectic. I've wanted to touch, I can't, you know, people ask, well, who's your favorite composer? I can't give you a single name. There are too many. I can go back in history in standard rep and tell you who I've always loved. And in terms of contemporary composers, the list just went on. It's like, because I was discovering all this music. Oh my God, I like this person. I like this person. And this person's music. And with John, there was such an eclecticism in his output from the early works through the what was to come at that time of the later works in the next 10 years that, you know, Ivar also said, he goes, oh, we should do pieces of John's from different periods. Like I did the two pieces 1935, and then he said we should do some of the prepared pieces, and then it was The Wonderful Widow, and then he had been playing the Suite for Toy Piano, and when I discovered In a Landscape and Dream, you know, of course everybody loves those pieces, and they're right. They're perfect on programs. So I started to intersperse and do programs that were theme oriented, involving music by different composers, and John's music sort of made it on a lot of those programs because of the unique quality and difference from piece to piece. And I always loved composers who really, you know, they and if you look at the trajectory of their career, they keep shifting and turning corners. And I love that about composers. Sure. Who do. And many times composers have to do that to stay relevant as the times move forward and the next generation of composers comes forward, you know?
Yes, of course, of course. I find myself responding to people who give me their opinion about Cage's music, which happens all the time.
Right.
To whether or not they say, oh, I love Cage's music, or I hate Cage's music.
Oh, yeah.
I find myself responding by saying all of it, regardless of whether or not they love it or hate it, because it is so different, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to qualitatively speak about the prepared piano pieces against the late number pieces, against yeah. the theater works, you know, against the really conceptual things like the songbooks, you know,
right.
where anything goes. So anyway, I get what you're saying.
It's, and I was able to watch the expansion of some of those larger theater pieces, like Ivar brought me with him to the New Music Chicago Festival in Chicago in 1982. And Neely Bruce and his wife at the time had done a realization of the songbooks. And it was very creative. It was very fun. They mounted certain more theatrical pieces at the University of Buffalo at the time, too, and with invited guests and all that. So I think what happened is then, you know, doing The Wonderful Widow, and I remember the first time John heard me do it, it was at this retrospective of his music in April of 82. It was before I went over to the Holland for the Gaudiamus competition, and I had entered that piece into my repertoire for the competition, because Ivar said, oh, you've got to do this at that competition, it's going to single you out. And at the same time, I discovered, he introduced me to Zhevsky's music. I included Jeffsky's music as well on my competition programs when I went. But prior to that, it was down at Cooper Union, this event. It was all day. Were you there?
I think yeah. so.
And I remember it snowed horribly that day. It was April 6, 1982. We got this freak snowstorm, but people still came out. And I think I played, I can't remember what else I did besides The Wonderful Widow, but John was like very, you know, he was very pleased. And it just made me feel really good. I felt good going off to a competition, knowing that I had the blessing, his blessing on performing.
Right, right, of course. So quality of Cage, wasn't it? That performers wanted to please him.
They yes, were, yes.
It meant a great deal.
And he was so, with me, he was always so welcoming. Like when it came time to do the recording, he just was delighted that I was pairing it with Meredith's music. And I remember we did the photo shoot at his loft. We went over there, Meredith and I, and it was just very fun. They were constantly joke. Everybody was just joking around. And that was the nature of the photo shoot. And we got some lovely shots because of it. I think then from that point on, I've always included him in any of my, any of my lecture demonstrations. Now those years that I was with young concert artists, they would send me to these different places around the country, and I would do these workshops for students. And I always included his music and showed one or two pieces that were very different from one another, just so they had perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that was important. But I mean, it was Ivar that really gave me that first encouragement. Of course, Jan Williams was also very encouraging as well. And that, like I said, it led me to the Gaudiamus competition, which the jury at the time was very impressed by the eclecticism of the pieces that I chose. And to this day, even with my own students in my classes at Manhattan School of Music, I really, really emphasize their need to be as diverse in their programming as they can. I offer this course called The Pianist in the 21st Century, which is more hands-on with the repertoire. They have to learn four different pieces each semester that come from our different categories. So whatever four one person is learning, someone else is learning four of completely different styles. Uh-huh. And you cover, I make sure that we cover John, not only historically from the 30s and 40s, but I also give them exercises like they have to realize one of the sections of ASLSP, mm-hmm. Which is throws them for a loop. And then in the second semester, they each get certain sections of the concert, piano concert, and that flips them out. But I get some great results from their realizations, which I think is actually great. So he's always been present because I found that he was the source of freedom for so many composers and for performers. I mean, I think it was unconscious that his influence, along with Ivar's encouragement, that I should be as eclectic and varied in my programming, and it served me well wherever I went. I didn't expect everybody to like everything on the programs, but people always seem to find at least two, three, or four pieces that they, if they weren't familiar with the repertoire, that they liked. And I think one of the most, you know, Frederick Jeffsky used to say, for him, one of the signs of a very successful concert was to be invited back. And I agree with that. But what I remember clearly was, what I realized after several years was, I think I found a concert to be successful when people came up afterward and said, where can I find recordings of this composer's music? Where can I find the scores? I want to know more about this composer or that composer, et cetera. And people had opinions about everything they heard, even if they heard it for the first time. And that told me that I was on the right track, you know, at the time. And also it was during the 80s, you know, and into the 90s, it was that crossing over from modernism into the mix of minimalism, into the mix of moving the next generation, moving it forward into the 90s. And I always felt that, and a lot of my colleagues felt this way, Kathy Sapove felt this way, Lisa Moore felt this way, that we had to keep going with the times, you know, in terms of programming. And so I think that with, you know, I mentioned my background in theater, which is what led to my doing, I worked with Meredith Monk's company for 3 years.
And I thought you did. This is, actually, I remember this, and that was in the 80s, was it not?
Yes. Yeah. I did the tour of Quarry out west and at, on the West Coast, and I did the game, we did the tour of the games on the West Coast. We did Quarry as a revival at La Mama.
I think I was there for that.
Yeah, it was part of those productions.
Interestingly, Tony, let me interrupt you really quickly, in that you've got Meredith Monk as this really strong influence on you as you're really developing, not a particularly young pianist or young performer, but young enough to be molded still. And you've got Meredith Monk and you've got Ivar, both of whom Cage adored. I mean,
I'll give you one other little anecdote. Is at that New Music Festival, New Music America in Chicago, one of the concerts was the first time I heard Meredith's music. She was a section of Turtle Dreams, and I thought it was the weirdest thing in the world, the whole staging of it. I didn't get it, and Ivar and I were in a cab after the concert, and I remember I was staring out the window of the cab, and I said to Ivar, would you think of that piece by Meredith Monk? And he was looking out the other window, and he just turned to me and he said, my dear, I think she should write you a piece. It's like, oh, you got to be kidding. He said, no, I really mean it. With your background in theater and dance, he said, you are perfect for her work. Hmm. And so when I went back to Buffalo, I was still in Buffalo at the time, I wrote her a note, and she sent me a little postcard back saying the next time I was in New York, we should meet. And the rest was history. She gave me some solo pieces that were in sketches that she had done as part of her larger scale works. And then I told her I wanted to do some of the vocal stuff, and I worked directly with her on that. Uh-huh. You know, of course, she's very picky and discerning about how you manage the vocal. The piano playing was never, she always accepted the piano playing, you know, unless I was playing too fast.
Right.
No, the vocal stuff, I learned an enormous amount. I had some coachings with her vocal coach along the way as well. And I just think that did influence, because when Frederick Jevsky heard me do her stuff in Belgium several years later, and I had then incorporated a piece that Frederick wrote called Lost and Found from 1985, which was for a percussionist. It's done at a table. It's based on that letter by the Vietnam War veteran.
Okay.
Where the piece basically is, you're reciting the letter in fragments. I mean, you're reciting the letter, but it's cut up in phrases. And as the piece progresses, the actions, the sounds on the table and on the body get more violent, because the letter is this lieutenant congratulating himself on this big great class he gave young GIs on how to kill people, how to do ambushes. Right. And Frederick's, all the mechanical sounds on the and percussive sounds on the table and on the body were the unconscious beating up on the self. So this dichotomy that was this inner struggle and fight going on for the performer.
I don't know the work. It sounds powerful.
Yeah, I've done it many times. And he technically wants it done naked. I always wore little shorts because he said that was fine. And we staged it. I staged it at a simple table with a hanging, beaming light, a light like as if you were in the barracks late at night writing this letter, because he was writing the letter to his grandmother, I believe, the lieutenant. And so we had that setting, and then the piece just starts to come alive, and it gets more and more violent and aggressive. And I think after that was when he introduced the idea that he said he was always interested in Oscar Wilde's final letter, De Profundis, and he had already done some pieces for narrator with ensemble, and he thought that would be the way to go again. But he really was thinking, and that's when we started talking back and forth with each other about, wouldn't it be interesting if the solo performer, the idea of the pianist doing both, and both instrument and body becoming part of this organic fusion, where the energy keeps passing through the keyboard, through the body, through the voice, etc. And that led to De Profundis, which I think is still to this day the pinnacle, or kingpin, if you will, the pinnacle of that genre that started. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, I know I've been credited, people have credited me with being the pioneer of that genre. I mean, that genre goes back to the 19th century. I mean, Liszt wrote these cheesy melodramas.
Of course.
Ivar used to play them with an actor who was reciting them. But Ivar was very, very encouraging. When I told him that Frederick was going to write this piece, this was just a couple years before he died, before Ivar died. He just thought it was the next step on my ladder of moving forward.
Uh-huh. It sounds like it was.
Oh yeah, yeah. The piece,
you had Jevsky as a kind of guide.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's written me four pieces over the course of his career.
What else? What else?
What followed was the piece, you know, the piece, The Road?
That, I do. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mile 50, I think it's mile 57 or 50, I think it's mile 58, is called Marriage. It's based on a thing he did on a Leo Tolstoy short story. He did it when he had written this thing called the Kreutzer Sonata, because the story is that this violinist is playing Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata with this woman is accompanying this violinist who's playing Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata. Her husband is excessively jealous of her, and he goes crazy, and he thinks they're having an affair, and he ends up killing his wife. So Frederick did this as like a 2-minute thing where you're rattling off the text. You're like four characters in 2 minutes rattling this. And the piano part is like rambling all over the place. And then he decided to expand it as part of The Road. He called it Marriage. And he used more of the text from the Leo Tolstoy short story. And he dedicated it to me and Tomoko Mukayama, the Japanese pianist, who had also been doing some of his speaking pieces as well. And then when it came to the Sondheim project, it's a funny story. Getting Frederick to choose a song to set was like pulling teeth.
Why?
First of all, we went through 14 songs and he couldn't make a decision. And he said, well, you know, I've always told audiences this, you know, Frederick says, well, I'm very intrigued by this project. You know, I consider Sondheim the Schoenberg of the musical theater. And from that point, we went through these songs and he loved the orchestrations. I revealed, well, Sondheim does do his own orchestrations. Most of them were Jonathan Tunick, but Sondheim makes a lot of indications and collaborations with Jonathan Tunick about right. The orchestrations. And Frederick was, oh, well, this is new information. And it was and so we had also at the time when the project started invited Milton Babbitt, because of course Sondheim studied with Milton Babbitt. It was one of his most influential teachers, along
it's
with
amazing us. To me. I find this amazing.
No, everybody says that. Yeah. The pairing of the two, and they remained friends. And so we made sure to invite Milton into the project. And of course, he barely started what he was going to do with it, and then he had passed away. And Milton had chosen the song. I had asked him if he would. I mean, we always gave the composers free choice of which song they want. But I sort of said, Milton, would you consider doing I'm Still Here from Follies? It would just be such a great thing at 93 years old. And he said, yeah. I said, and I took a step further. I said, Milton, would you be willing to go back to your writing style before 1950 or 1940? Because he was writing cabaret music for.
Right.
He said, sure, I think I could do that. And I was like so excited. Like, this is going to blow audiences away that you're going to hear this take of Milton Babbitt that they're so used to hearing, you know, his modernistic side. In any case, after Milton died and Frederick was still struggling with trying to choose something, we were going back and forth. I just took the bull by the horns and said, Frederick, this is what we're going to do. I said, we have that commission money for you. You are going to set I'm Still Here from Follies, and you're going to dedicate it to Milton because you studied with him and Sondheim studied with him. So there's a perfect triangle connection here between the three of you. I said, and this is great. And Frederick was like, oh, well, this is going to be a major undertaking. He treated it very seriously. Well, first of all, what he came up with was a piece called The News. And it had barely had anything to do with the song. You could never tell it was the song. There was a little bit of text at the beginning. And the piece is actually kind of really great. It's interesting. And I went back to him and said, Frederick, this, you know, one of the things we asked in the project is to retain the melodic material as best and some of the harmony. Sondheim said that the structure of the instrumental version of these songs was going to be different. He understood that because he said his musical material was more condensed and expanded by lyrics and narrative. So he said he understood that when it came to an instrumental piece, that this was going to have a slightly different structure or form. Some people did do exact transcriptions, and others, you know, took the reimagining word to heart. With Frederick, I just said, Frederick, you didn't retain any of the melody. I said, you got one little motive in there, and no one's going to know that. He said, oh, well, okay. Well, 2 months later, he sends I'm Still Here, which was beautiful. It was still a little deconstructed, but it was in there.
It was recognizable.
And he put an improvisation, optional improvisation. And I said, Frederick, I'm going to do the improv and I'm going to make it come directly from the song so that they really know that this is what it's been.
He said, well, it sounds like that was a perfect thing to do anyway, because
he said that was the reason he put it in. He said he realized I suspected you would do that with the improv. That's why I put it in. So, and it worked out really well. It's a beautiful version of a setting of the song. And Sondheim really liked it. So, I mean, it worked out, but I mean, it was a wonderful process to get Frederick to that point that involved Milton Babbitt.
Right. What year was this?
When did he finally?
Because Jeff, when did he die?
21, June
21.
Of
21. So this was.
Well, he finished the piece in 2012 or 13.
Okay.
Because we started getting the first pieces around 2000, the end of 2008 into 2009, the first pieces came in. And we did a kind of soiree fundraiser at our apartment, not here, at our previous apartment, which was much larger at the time, with Sondheim and invited guests. So he could hear the first I had the first eight pieces in. Mm-hmm. And it was a great evening. And a lot of people who came decided they wanted to commission. It was a wonderful way of getting more
of
the other commissions. Yeah, I mean, my producer for my co-producer on this project, Rachel Colbert, is a genius with all the ways she came up of raising money and just seeing things through. When there was a curve, she knew how to go in the back door. I mean, she always knew how to maneuver.
Can we borrow her? Are you renting her out?
Oh, I should tell her. I'll have her listen to this. She's going to get a big charge out of it.
But I wanted to ask you a question. Oh, just out of curiosity. So how many composers overall have you worked with on this project?
Well, it started with, it was going to be only about 20 or 25. It expanded to 36 because I had asked Sondheim early on his suggestions for composers, and he sent me a list, several of which were already on my list, but a lot of them were musical theater composers who he said played the piano well and he thought would do a good job.
Uh-huh.
And then when I sent him the list, my suggested list of who I wanted to invite, I had already invited several people, but I sent him, he was like, oh my God, I can't believe this A list of composers would be interested in setting my melodies and harmonies. He was very touched and very honored by it.
Uh-huh. So, he was a generous man, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. He was so supportive of this project from the get-go, from the moment we received the first letter from him. Because I went through, to start, I have a very, very close friend, one of my oldest friends. We were raised together. We're from the same town. He's a very prominent theater agent here in New York for many years now. And I called him and said, and he goes, we have the name of one of his lawyers. You can send it to one of the lawyers. And Rachel and I constructed the letter and sent it. And the lawyer sent it directly to Sondheim. And a week or two later, I get this note in my mailbox from Sondheim saying he was intrigued by the whole idea and we should keep discussing. And that's what started it.
I've known so many people, I can't even count them all. So many people who reached out to him for one thing or another, if only just for encouragement, you know.
Yes.
And he always wrote them back.
Everybody has those little cards. I have a whole collection right here on my desk.
It's so sweet. It's just so
sweet. And then we finally switched. After 2 years, we switched to email because it was going back and forth so much. This was getting ridiculous. So finally his assistant called and said, it was Steve Klar. He called me and said, Tony, I think the boss said we can switch to email.
Nice.
In any case, we expanded to 36 because we thought it was a perfect round number. And he also suggested a few more composers, people who he knew, like Thomas Newman from the film world, who I didn't know.
Sure.
And Thomas Newman was more than pleased to be able to do this. Everybody was on board. I mean, whoever we asked said yes. There were a few I asked that declined because they said they didn't know enough about his work to feel like they could do something. Several years later, they said they were kicking themselves in the butt.
I was going to say, more's the pity. They should have run out and gotten those recordings as fast as possible.
Right. In any case, we did the 36. It's 36 plus one because I did one to start. I did a sort of a melange of sections from Sunday in the Park with George, because we needed something for the website at the time. And I never really programmed it until much later. And then ECM, when we recorded, decided I should record it, because I would play it sometimes as encores, and people liked it. So it's now published with the rest of the pieces. So there were that 37. So, but I still consider, I call it 36 plus one. Then in 2017, this was long after the recording had come out, that came out in 2015, my manager at the time just called and said, you know, he's going to be turning 90 in 2020. Have you thought about that? So Rachel and I talked. By about 2018, we decided, well, I always wanted to expand it to 50. So we invited 14 more, including some from the newer generation. Wow. And we raised the money for the commissions again. And so we got 14 more. They were to be premiered in two concerts at the 92nd Street Y in 2020. And the lockdown happened a week before the first concert. And so, you know,
there you have it.
And I had 2020 was going to be this. My schedule for 2020 was jam packed because everybody, all these other venues said they wanted to hear the new piece. So everything great. I was grateful. Everything later on got rescheduled. People, yeah, you know,
of course,
scheduled again.
I'm curious. So I have a question for you. The reason I asked you about the number of people, were you ever in a position of having to sway someone away from a song towards something else?
We told everyone that they were free to choose the same song as someone else. And I have a lot of stories about each composer's method of choosing and why they were choosing and how they chose. Because some of them are just so interesting and so wonderful. Everybody says I should write a book about the project.
Tony, you could write a book just on that subject. It would be fascinating.
Right. Like, you know, in the case of Steve Reich chose quickly. He chose Finishing the Hat from Sunday in the Park with George. And I was trying to push Steve Reich to choose from Pacific Overtures, because Sondheim said that when he wrote Pacific Overtures in 1974, whenever it was, 74, 75, he said that he had been thinking a lot about Steve Reich's music, and they've known each other for years. And so I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if Steve Reich chose from Pacific Overtures? And I specifically wanted him to do Someone in a Tree. And Steve, he came back and said, Tony, I love Pacific Overtures, but he says, my heart is set on Finishing the Hat. I said, that's perfectly fine. Originally, he was going to do it for four pianos where I'd have to record tracks. And then he decided to make it two pianos, which is great. And that was that.
Both live pianos.
Yeah, I've done it with other pianists. And for a lot of times when I go off solo, I had already pre-recorded the second track for myself. Uh-huh. So I sort of accompany myself. What happened is Finishing the Hat being such a popular beloved song by everyone. A lot of composers came up and said, oh, it's Finishing the Hat. I said, it's taken Steve Reich. I said, but if you want to do another version, no, I'll choose something different.
Okay, so good. Step aside.
Right. Yeah. There's only one overlap. It is Being Alive. And that's because in the first group, Gabriel Kahane did it. And in the new crop, Kevin Putz did it. They're very different from one another. One is the perspective. Gabriel Kahane's version is the perspective having to do with the character of Bobby in the story of Company, where Gabe didn't think that at the end, Bobby really did want to get married. So the whole thing is in his setting, every time he gives you a section of the song, he takes it away from you because Bobby is always running away from every girl that he's involved.
Nice. Very nice.
The metaphor correspondence of the two made it very interesting. And he touches on a little bit on Copland, a little bit on Bernstein, a little bit, he was touching on these different composers in it. Kevin went for the song. I mean, Kevin is a harmony person. He says he loves Sondheim's harmonies. So he made this virtuosic, really wonderful version that starts quietly and just keeps building and building the way the song builds. But without, it's you know it's the song, but it's really about the harmonies in the song.
Makes perfect sense, actually.
Yeah. Everyone else chose something that no one else had chosen. And what we were delighted with in the new batch, the new commissions, was that people were choosing songs that I wanted originally that no one chose.
Uh-huh.
Not a Day Goes By. I don't know how many composers I pushed that on. Fred Hirsch almost did it, but he settled on No One Is Alone. And there were others that there was one from Passion that I really wanted that no one really knew, but
Passion was the dark one. It was that was the one that didn't do entirely well in New York. I loved it.
I did too. And Paola Prestini chose from that. And what else? I'm just blanking out right now. What else was chosen? Chris Cerrone chose Kiss Me from Sweeney Todd. He did it with electronics.
Uh-huh.
It's wonderful. It has that frenetic energy that Kiss Me has with the quartet.
That's a really basic question. I should have asked you this to start. So not everybody was a pianist. You had some people who realized these in other ensembles or other solo instruments, or no?
No, everybody did it for the piano. There were two or one of our criteria is we wanted composers who really wrote well for the piano, but
okay.
A couple of them did not. Like, but we were intrigued because of the genre they were in. And one was Duncan Sheik theater pop composer. Theater and pop composer. And, you know, Duncan's also, he set Joanna, and he did it with electronics as well. But the electronics was, he's a guitarist. He recorded all these guitar licks and then manipulated them on the computer to sound like this atmospheric wash behind the piece. And he asked me
for this to come out. I just can't wait for it.
Well, the Duncan Sheik is on the original.
It's on the original, but I'm just saying it's a
new one. Right. I'm recording.
So does the new set that's coming out, is it Avi or AV?
It's Avi.
Label. Avi.
Yeah, I do the first 7 of the 14 in 2 weeks, and then the other 7 in August. And hopefully, technically, it'll come out at the end of the year.
Is Avi going to be inclusive of everything that came out on the 2015? Is it everything, or is it a?
No, it's just the new pieces.
It's
this
just
will
the
be
new pieces.
A single disc, whereas the ECM recording was a 3-disc box.
Right.
And I was going to say one other thing about that. What was I going to say? Sorry.
No,
I just blanked out.
About Sheik.
Oh, right. So Duncan also, he doesn't really play the piano. His piano part was so easy. He said, Tony, feel free to embellish this. So I went through and added in things, and he seemed very pleased with it. And that's the version we publish with the collection. And then another composer, Jarek Bischoff, who comes from the pop music world, he also did not really play the piano. He's an electric guitarist. And so he asked me to embellish a little as well, which we did.
Nice.
Everybody has written for the piano.
Okay. And what's the balance roughly between sort of pop world composers and classical world composers?
Let's say the highest percentage is the contemporary classical composers, of course. But our whole goal was to spread the net wide to include other genres. That was one of the unique and foundational aspects of the project. So the jazz composers, there's about 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
Theater composers, there's also about 5 or 6. Indie, there's 2 or 3. Pop, maybe 3. What else? Opera composers are in with contemporary classical, but they write, like Jake Heggie primarily writes opera. So, you know, we sort of lumped him in there. What else? Jazz, indie, theater, film.
Of course.
I invite, you know, besides Tom Newman, Peter Golub, and in the new batch, Jeff Beal, who has done so many great television and scores. I mean, I didn't know Jeff Beal's music, but when I heard he did House of Cards, and I remember the first time I watched that show, that opening credit music just completely intrigued me. So when it came time to choose, I remember saying to Rachel, we have to have Jeff Beal.
Right.
Like, well, that's the response I want.
Did he know of Sondheim when you reached out to him? Did he know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He chose Not a Day Goes By. You know, I didn't even tell him I wanted it. He just chose it. I was very pleased.
Anything not get in there that you wanted?
Oh, yeah. Company, the opening number of Company.
Oh, yeah. Really?
There's the opening number of Pacific Overtures, The Advantages of Floating in the Middle of the Sea. Several people considered it, but it's, again, the production numbers were, I was very impressed by what the composers did with condensing those production numbers.
Those are hard. It's hard work.
Into the Woods, what Andy Akio did with Preparations, you know, in honor of Kate, of John. He made the preparation simple so that they could travel and be extracted easily when you're done, so it doesn't disrupt the flow of the concert. I mean, he was very clever, but it's such a great, it's an 8-minute condensed version of what is a 12 to 14 minute opening prologue.
Right.
Kenji Bunch took the Ballad of Sweeney Todd, the opening, and he made it into a 5-minute, really virtuosic piece. Mason Bates took Putting It Together from Act Two of Sunday in the Park with George and made it a 3-minute monstrous etude, mashing the two tunes together that are part of the two melodies in the song. And it's just one of the most fascinating pieces in the whole collection.
Do you have any singers?
What do you mean?
Real singers. I mean, do you have anybody who's primarily a singer?
A composer singer?
Yeah.
Meredith. Meredith is in the second bunch. She didn't want to do it the first time around. I think she was a little intimidated by it, and she said this was years ago. But when I went back to her for the second, she said she would strongly consider it.
So what did she choose?
She chose Poems from Pacific Overtures. She did a very unique setting of it. It's very different.
Well, it sounds like there was a lot of leeway as to what somebody could do with what they were working, the original. That's something like an ensemble finale that you could somehow make it into a lyric, a 2-minute lyric.
I mean, the other thing was like someone like Jake Heggie took A Weekend in the Country from a little.
Jake Heggie is in there.
He was in the original, right?
Oh my God.
He was one of the first ones we got, one of the first pieces we got. And he and Sondheim had known each other for years.
Yeah.
But Jake, again.
We were in college together, he and I.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were at UCLA when he and Johanna got married.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He condensed that big production number of A Weekend in the Country.
Uh-huh.
He called it I'm Excited, No You're Not, which is one of the lyrics. Some of them chose as their title a lyric, like Tim O'Andres in The New Batch did I Know Things Now from Into the Woods, Little Red Riding Hood song.
Right,
and he
right.
calls it nice is different than good, because that's one of the prominent lyrics in the whole song. Yeah, I mean, it's some people changed the title a little, others kept the title. Some were direct transcriptions or arrangements, but the word reimagining, people did, a lot of them took that to heart. One of the ones I think Sondheim, he commented that he thought was so beautiful was Mark Anthony Turnage's, the British composer, his setting of Pretty Women from Sweeney Todd, because he did the very quiet, easy, transparent setting of it. And it's almost meditative. And Sondheim really loved it. Some of them went like Tom Newman did Not While I'm Around from Sweeney Todd. And it's also kind of meditative. I mean, they all, you know, they chose right for themselves. What we always said, I say this in every interview, is that every single piece is basically the perfect marriage between the original Sondheim material and the composer's style. So that when you hear the piece, you know it's that composer.
Right. That mitigated against telling people what to do.
I had a wish list, a big wish list. I told them they didn't have to stick to it. Many chose from that list. Some, like another story, I've told the story before. When I invited David Rakowski, I was playing a piece of his at a concert at Merkin Hall. This is years ago. And I invited David and he said, yeah, this sounds great. And one of the songs that I didn't put on the list, which I love, but I didn't think it would make at the time. I didn't know if it would make a good piano piece because it was so character and lyric driven, was The Ladies Who Lunch from Company. Uh-huh. And the first thing David looked at me, he said, has anyone chosen The Ladies Who Lunch? And I said, no. He goes, oh, that's the one I definitely want to do. And he made this version that is just incredible. It is the song. He gets her humor. He gets the humor, passion, bitterness, and sadness of the character all in it. He retains the bossa nova. And it's the song is there. It's a real sweep of what is done in the song. And Sondheim was also very fond of that one. So composers ask, you know, it's funny when they always ask, have you played it for him yet? What did he say? What did he say?
Exactly. Oh, no, I want to say that.
Right. And if he made a suggestion and I went back to the composer and said, well, he said that. Oh, yeah, do that. Yeah, do that. Please do that.
He's again like Cage, you know, it's like people who knew Sondheim or didn't know him even, but knew his work, were working around his music, wanted him to like it.
Yes.
Wanted him to approve.
Right.
We're almost out of time, but I want to make sure that people understand what we're doing here, because because you have this incredibly beautiful, varied career, which is your midstream. I can't wait to see what you do next.
That's what everybody says. And I'm trying to everybody says, what's your next project? I'm like, well, it will not be as big as this one.
You're not even done. You're not quite done with this one. So we won't push you yet. But I just can't wait to see what you're going to do next. Are you going to go back to the stage, do you think?
What do you mean?
Well, more live performance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I do, I mean, there are two other projects in the works. They're for solo works. Uh-huh. Well, one is a piano concerto. One is a large solo work. The solo work has a great premise to it. And the concerto, I can't reveal anything about yet.
Is that because you don't know anything yet?
Well, I know.
It's okay. It's okay.
Little Red Riding Hood said, I know things now. No, and then there's a bigger project. It's a little bigger. It's not as big as this, obviously. That it's been incubating for several years. I just have to realize it.
Mm-hmm. Great.
That's basically I wanted to wait till the recording was done of the new pieces. Plus, we just did that big Zhevsky Festival at Merkin last weekend.
I'm so sorry that I couldn't attend. I didn't even know about it until it was almost on top of us.
Right. He's going to put it, John Glover at Merkin, he's thinking of putting it all up on a single page on their website.
Nice.
So people can refer to the different pieces and have access to the scores, because that's what Zhevsky wanted. So
this is a question, though, for your Sondheim project, this multi-year project that you've been doing, are they going to be published together as a book? Do we have
hold on a minute.
Yeah, you guys can't see us, but Tony just
off. Okay, right. I'm
it's
sorry
okay. It's that, okay.
We're
I,
on
I
radio
them dramatically.
The first 36 plus one were published in 2016 or 2017.
Okay. Excellent.
It's Rilting Music. It's a subsidiary. It's an imprint of Hal Leonard. Rilting is the imprint of Hal Leonard that publishes Sondheim. Uh-huh. So they're all in here with a great. There's comments from each composer about their piece.
This is fantastic. This is fantastic.
One from Sondheim, one from me, one about the project, and a complete list of the first 37. Mm-hmm. And people have bought them. Students have already been playing them, and people.
Excellent. Well, I assume so, because you're
right
onto all this. And
the new pieces will be available for everybody to play at the end of this year, because we were waiting until the recording was finished. And then those will probably be published next year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing. We have, it's that process that they all have to go back to the composer. We have to.
It's a nightmare.
Doing this took 2 or 3 months
just
to get
the copyright papers.
Right. Right. So yeah, they will be. Everything will be available. But these are all available, and the recording of the first 37 are available.
Okay, good to know. All right. Well, we're going to stop our conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Same here. This is great.
You feel like a find. Like. You're a fine.
<It's so nice.
laughs> If you were mine, I'd nickname you that.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Anyway, I'm thrilled about your work, and I really do want to hear more. So if you ever want to come back and talk with me more about what
I'd
you're
love
doing.
To do that.
Yes.
These are great fun.
A pleasure, Tony. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was for me too, and I really appreciate you doing this. Thank you again.
My pleasure. In perusing the Pianos and Voices CD for selections to play for you at the close of tonight's program, I think we're going to leave this to chance a little bit. It's a ridiculous thing to say. I really would love to play all of them for you, and we just don't have time. So I'm going to play the two pieces for piano, the one titled Slowly and the one titled Quite Fast, back to back, and then I'm going to play for you The Wonderful Widow of 18 Springs from 1942 and Nauwerth upon Nacht from 1984, so that you can hear a little bit of Anthony in all of his glory. Enjoy.
by silent sailing night. Isobel, wild woods eyes and primrose. So still she lay, neath of the white thorn, child of tree. Like some lost happy leaf, like blowing flowers still, as fain would she anon, for soon again 'twill be win me, woo me, wed me. Ah, weary me deeply. Now even Sister Isobel, sainted Isobel, Madame Isobel, La
Belle. Now the pun knocked. While in his tumbril watched men have a look, see queer scenes. From yon sides of the choppy, punked by his cursor bog, went long the grass gross bump in strass, that henders the pobble to pastoing his bottle, in a hole fort wet his wassail to stretch a crook's men. Sequestering four lovers, lost property of his sins, the leave things from all perjurer's night. Oh, nice! Oh, as nasty kickers, brillers, nappers, and bands, hands, boon, and strumper, sminky sticks, and etiquette's flaskers,